Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This program, while timely, as it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, actually came about through a totally unrelated project that I was working on. Paul Deepan published a fantasy novel, The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree. Now, people that know me also know that I'm not generally a fan of fantasy. Too many cutesy fairies and pixies for my liking. But Paul produced a very different book. It was nitty gritty, and there wasn't a cute fairy to be found. At the very core of the book was a pact. A 17-year-old is watching his mother die a gradual, painful, and self-worth destroying death from the ravages of breast cancer. Her son watches as little by little his mother withers away. Some might say that the boy made a pact with the devil. Paul, however, writes it as a pact with the universe. His mother must live. He cares. Not who dies or how many people die. He wants his mother to live. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Paul Deepan and his wife, Laurie Deepan, to the program. Hello to both of you.
Hello, Simon.
Hi, Simon.
Paul, you wrote The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree, and I believe it was about a month after you'd finished the first draft that Laurie received some very, very bad news. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. In 2008, I finished the first draft of my manuscript for The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree. And we were really happy that, you know, I'd done that, and this was a big project that I've been working on, that I'd taken time away from work to complete, that I'd received a lot of family support about. And then I think it was probably that happened in June or July, and of course then I was working with my editor, whom I believe I've mentioned to you before, Pat Labruto, and I sent the manuscript off to Pat to sort of get his feedback from it. And I was waiting for that turnaround time on pins and needles, as you do when you're waiting for someone who knows what they're doing to tell you what they think about your work and you feel like you don't know what you're doing. And Laurie discovered that she had a lump on her left breast that she found by self-examination. And within a couple of weeks after that, we had a diagnosis back that she did in fact have breast cancer.
Laurie, I know that you are a doctor, but I cannot begin to understand what must have been going through your mind when the news was broke that you had breast cancer.
Well, I was trying to convince myself that the little lesion that I'd felt and then saw on the mammogram and then had an ultrasound and spoke with the radiologist, and he said, this is absolutely, almost certainly benign. I would just follow it. And I said, no, I want it out of there, because I had this kind of ominous feeling that something wasn't quite right. I didn't feel quite right. I don't know how else to describe it. And this fellow was like, well, I think that this is overkill. And I said, well, I think if something's in your breast that shouldn't be there, it should come out. And that's what I tell my patients, and that's what I'm going to do. So when I got the phone call a couple days later, I'd been actually working hurricane relief for Gustav when it came up through, you know, it displaced a lot of people from Mississippi, and we here in Tennessee were doing some relief work for them as they were sent up here, and I was doing their medical care, and I was sitting in the parking lot of one of these compounds where we're keeping people, and the fella calls me and says, "I just don't have good news for you." And I said, "Oh, crap." And he said, "Yeah." And I think I spent more time telling him it was okay. He felt terrible, the radiologist telling me the bad news, and I was like, you know, that's okay. I had a suspicion. And he said, "Well, it's low grade, and they do a good job these days with these kind of things." And he really just wanted to get off the phone, and I said, "That's okay. We'll deal with it." And I really think the worst part of it was the 3 or 4 days waiting for the pathology results, and once you know what you're dealing with, then you can move forward. And that's kind of the way I did it. But, yeah, it was a bit devastating because, you know, you didn't know whether you were going to be alive at Christmas. You thought, oh, gosh, this is the worst part.
Yeah, I had a somewhat similar event happen to me. I managed to get pneumonia in the middle of summer, in the middle of Arizona, you know, which I'm still not sure how I got it. But it was pretty severe. And the medical whizzes decided that what they needed to do was investigate my lungs. As I recall, it was a very unpleasant deal that involved something going up my nose. Anyway, they came back, and they were quite gleeful, but they said, "We found a lump." You know, I went, "Oh, whoopee." So I spent an amount of time, you know, laying in this hospital bed going, "Oh, not the C word, not the C word."
Right.
And, you know, they came back something like 8 hours later, and they were all glum-faced. You know, it's benign. It was almost like they were, you know, looking for a good reason to slice and dice me.
Well, people like to explain things, too. They like to say the reason this happened was because of this. And even though it's good news for you, they probably had to try to figure out why you had pneumonia in the middle of summer.
Right. And, well, it was a teaching hospital as well. So, I mean,
Say no more.
Right. I guess they, yeah, they were going, "Oh, there goes a great chance." Paul, what was your first reactions when you heard the news?
You know, it's interesting that you've asked me that, because I figured that question was going to come up. And what I'm trying to wrap my head around while I hear Lori talk about those times and that time is, how much of it I've forgotten. And I wonder now if that, you know, isn't one of those sort of unconscious self-protective mechanisms that you do when you block out bad times. I remember feeling like, what does this mean, really? I knew a little bit about the disease state. I think I've told you about this before, Simon, you know, that I, with my background in pharmaceuticals and with cancer therapies in particular, and in breast cancer therapies specifically, I knew a little bit about the disease state. I knew a little bit about breast cancer. So a lot of the news that Lori had was positive, from the sense that her tumor was very small. It seemed to be caught, you know, very early. The pathology seemed to be very positive and all that kind of thing. But I didn't want to be too hopeful about that, because this was also a mass that she had been told was almost certainly benign. So everything that we were being told that it was probably nothing to worry about, you know, subsequently was something to worry about. So now we were being told that the pathology was looking very positive and your outcome's probably going to be really great, but I didn't want to put too much stock in that because nobody's prediction so far had come true, if you get what I'm saying. So I was very wary about accepting at face value the positive slant that the various physicians were putting on it.
Now, the pathology came back with a different answer.
Yeah, well, what they expected, definitely. And, you know, it was definitely an invasive cancer. And so next step was to see the surgeon. He said, of course, we're going to, I think we can do breast-sparing surgery. It's not a huge tumor. We'll have to take your lymph nodes under your left arm. And I fully expect that they will be negative, given the size of this tumor. And then you can just do radiation, and you'll be good, good to go, which, of course, didn't happen. It's like I woke up from the surgery, the nurse said, everything was great. Your lymph nodes were all negative. They got the entire tumor. You're excellent. I felt fine. And 3 days later, the surgeon calls me and says, there seems to be some malignant cells on one of the lymph nodes. And I thought, oh, great. I know enough about breast cancer to know that I just bought myself chemotherapy almost certainly, despite the size of the tumor. So I said, well, I'd like to see one of the oncologists that I've sent patients to for 10 years who I know very well. And we sat down and went through the numbers very methodically, looked at the studies, looked at 10-year survival, plugged in all my information into databases and came up with, yep, we're going to do this. So she said, you know, you don't have to. But I said, would you? And she said, absolutely. I said, well, then I have to. And so a week later, I was getting hooked up and getting chemotherapy.
I have to ask this. You are a doctor. You understand way more about the subject than, you know, Jane Doe. Do you think the medical profession does enough to explain to patients exactly what's going on?
I think that's very dependent on the providers that you have. You know, patients that I've subsequently have that have been in the same boat as I was in, I'll go through things with them in detail. And it takes time. And, you know, the way the whole medical system is set up, time is money. So the more time you spend, the less people make. So I think you have to kind of seek out, almost by word of mouth, the people that will care for you like they would care for their own, and take as much time as is necessary. So I do think in some situations people end up not having a clue what's been done to them or why. And then in other situations, I think there's, if you're in with the right mix of people, you'll get all the support you need, if not more.
Cancer moves very swiftly, and so must the medical profession. How long was it between diagnosis and action in your particular instance?
I think my surgery was on the 6th of October, and my first chemotherapy was on the 28th of October. So about 2.5 weeks, I was, you know, already starting treatment.
Is there a history of cancer in your family?
There's, you know, it's interesting. There's a bit of a bias when someone gets diagnosed. All of a sudden, all your relatives come out of the woodwork and say, well, you know, Aunt May had that, and Grandma so-and-so had that. And I said, she lived to be 98. I don't really think that was what killed her. And it's just kind of a curious thing, but when it all boiled down to getting the right information, probably there wasn't any breast cancer on, certainly on my mother's side of the family, or there might have been one my father's sister may have had breast cancer, but of course that was so long ago, and she's been gone for a long time. No one really could pin it down. My mother's sister did have ovarian cancer, and there is an ovarian cancer breast cancer genetic link, so that people got curious about that. But I think I started the family history for real in my family.
So
I have a twin sister.
You don't view it as something that's multi-generational, at least not in your situation.
No, not at all. No. And, you know, I called my sister. I have a twin sister. I called her up and I said, here's the bad news. You know, I've just given you the history. And she said, well, I just went and had all my stuff done and I'm fine. And she only has daughters. And I said, well, they have to be vigilant, you know, because now they've got, on the mother's side, they've got a history. But we chose not to do genetic markers or so on because we just didn't feel that there was enough risk there to go through the chance of getting false negatives and false positives and having more surgery for maybe not the right reason.
Paul, I'm going to go back to you again. You're watching this story unfold. I mean, what was going through your mind?
It's a helpless feeling, really, at the end of the day, to watch somebody that you care about so much have to deal with this. There's not really a lot you can do except listen and provide emotional support. And, you know, trust in the care that one thing I will say is that the care that Laura got was amazingly good. And obviously people do hear horror stories about people who get less than adequate care, and that's really tragic. But we were very fortunate in our case, and I think I'd also known Laura's oncologist professionally, as it turned out, and coincidentally, independently of Lori, and I had every confidence that she was absolutely the best choice of person to be looking after Lori. And at the end of the day, you almost have to, if you believe that, you almost have to surrender yourself to the process and do everything you can do, make sure that, you know, your spouse does everything she's supposed to do, and trust that you'll get a good outcome. But it's a very helpless feeling at the end of the day, and I don't think men are particularly well prepared emotionally, you know, by nature, genetically, and certainly by the way society trains us to behave when we are confronted with a problem or a crisis, to essentially be forced into a role of inactive looking on. It's very, very difficult.
Laurie, I work with an interesting husband and wife research team out of Southern California. Manny Barling is the survivor of a bout with colon cancer, and his wife, Ashley Brooks, a survivor of breast cancer. They both firmly believe that, you know, while some people may have a predisposition to cancer, there are preventative measures, primarily in the area of what you eat. You know, nutrition is important. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's true. You know, you can look at all the studies that link certain types of cancers with, you know, with nutritional background and so on, like breast cancer tends to be more likely to occur in women who are heavier than the average bear kind of thing, and who don't breastfeed their kids. I mean, it was a joke in the house. It's like, wow, I did everything right, and I still ended up getting this. So it's hard to put your finger on what makes a cell go wrong. But I do think people are more prone. I think their immune system, if they don't have good nutrition, if they're not, you know, fit and doing the best thing they can do for themselves, I think their immune system takes a hit, and I think that when the defense is down, immune system-wise, that's probably when cells start to act funny and mutate in a way that they shouldn't. So I think you just have to try to do everything the best you can and take care of yourself. You know how people say treat your body as a temple, and I don't think many of us do that. But I think it's an important way to kind of live your life and not take things for granted.
Paul, we have talked several times. You and Lori are the proud parents of some children. How old are they, or how old were they when Lori was diagnosed?
In 2008, they were 17 and 13, respectively, Ben and Josh. Ben was a 17-year-old, and Josh was 13. And now Ben is 19, and Josh is 15. So there's been a lot of maturation for both of them, and I think that this episode in their lives, to watch their mom have to deal with this and watch how I dealt with it, you know, as a role model, as a male role model for them, was, you know, not necessarily a pleasant experience, obviously, but certainly something that allowed them to grow in a funny kind of way.
When you say grow, I mean, what were their initial reactions?
You know, that's hard to really put my finger on even now. I think they were a lot more scared than they wanted to let on. And I think that at the same time, they wanted to be there for their mom. And in that way, in both of those two ways, I think they mirrored my own response. It was almost identical. I was a lot more scared than I wanted to let on. And I obviously tremendously wanted to be there as a support to Lori and also to the boys. And I think that that's kind of how they approached it as well. And one thing, you know, you must know is that Lori and I are kind of warped in terms of our sense of humor, and our boys have definitely picked up that trait. And I think humor played, you know, a very big role in how we were able to navigate as a family through this whole, you know, journey that we undertook together. Do you want me to share that story that we've talked about before? I mean, it's...
Oh, I was just about to bring it up.
Wonderful. Well, I mean, I sort of laid it up for you so well, I thought, well, now I just have to talk. You know, our younger son, Josh, is both the boys are very, very funny. Ben tends to be a bit more quiet and has a very dry sense of humor. Both Lori and I have English and Scottish backgrounds, respectively, and you know, that sort of dry British wit comes through a lot in our interactions, and Ben is definitely like that. Josh is also just very comical, and you know, we would say a lot of funny things to each other about stuff that was happening, but I think the line we best remember is when Lori lost her hair during chemotherapy. I mean, this woman has wonderfully thick, rich hair, and it was one of the features that I found most attractive when we began dating, you know, a long time ago. And to see her lose it was a sort of visual symbol that, yes, she really is sick. And also, it's for me, it was the part that kind of was a visual symbol of attacking who she was in a funny kind of way. That was the piece of me that really got sad when I watched that happen. And I think it was tough for the boys to see that too, but Josh in particular was really funny. One day he looked at his mom and he basically said, you know, you're losing your hair, Mom. And she was like, yes, like, no kidding. And he goes, well, can I have your shampoo then? Because basically you're not going to need it for a while. And that was one of those things that we just all really, I mean, it was laugh out loud funny at the time, and we all laughed out loud. And to be able to do that, I think, was tremendously healing and also tremendously strengthening for all of us as we went through.
Yeah, when we'd go somewhere, I'd say, is everybody ready? And Josh would look at me and say, I think you need to fix your hair. And I'd say, right. You know, just funny little things like that. I was quicker to get ready in the morning.
Indeed. my wife and I lost a very good friend, I think it was about 3 years ago, and she went through, chemotherapy, lost all of her hair, in an attempt to bolster her self-esteem, if you will. You know, she was given wigs, and she said, "No, I don't want them. Don't need them. I am who I am." Was that the way you approached it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, at work, some of the nurses would give me like little stocking caps or whatever. I had a few pretty funky tie-dye type head scarves, but I did. I wouldn't have gone the wig route at all. I mean, I just said, you know, if it bothers people, let me know and I'll cover it. But for the most part, people I worked with said, it doesn't bother us at all. Just go ahead. And I just carried on. It's just your appearance. It's not you. I mean, you're still the same person. Some people, if it made them uncomfortable, I would obviously be sensitive to that. But for the most part, I wouldn't have gone the wig routine. I did mess around with a couple of afros just at the office to do a little song and dance routine at some of our meetings, but nothing that I'd keep on.
There were some funny moments around that too, Simon, because, you know, sometimes the hats that Lori would wear would make her head really hot. And I remember one time she was in the drive-thru of some fast food restaurant getting, you know, a coffee or something like that, and she had taken her hat off while she was looking at the change, and she drove through, and when she got to the window, she was, you know, completely bald, and it was just not what the poor little girl at the window was expecting. She kind of had, oh my gosh, what is this? But other times people would come up and say stuff to us, and I remember one time my older boy plays hockey, and we had gone somewhere, I think it was Atlanta area, to watch him in a tournament, and we'd gone out to get something to eat after his game, and it was just Lori and I, and we were sitting there, and this other couple was in the restaurant, and it was just the four of us, and the restaurant staff, and they got up and left a little bit ahead of us, and we went to get up to pay, and the lady said, oh, that couple that was here before you bought your dinner for you. And so people can be tremendously kind. And that was a real eye-opening piece of this whole journey that was very good for us, because we were the beneficiaries of a lot of kindness from a lot of people, some of whom were complete strangers. And so that was that wouldn't have happened without this nasty thing happening. So, yeah, it wasn't very nice, but there was a lot of really good stuff that happened as a result of it, and a lot of appreciations that we all had that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
I'm a firm believer in, happenstance and kindness from strangers. In my life and my wife's life, it has happened too many times to ignore. You know, the strangest things happen at the strangest times. And you must have come across that with the the story you just told.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. If people, I used to say to Paul when I'd come home, I'd tell him something that happened, you know, like the lady in the drive-thru line who said, oh, are you going to be okay? And I thought, I wonder what she's talking about. And then I realized, here I am sitting there all bald, and I said, oh, yeah, I'm going to be great. She said, well, God bless you. I hope you do fine. I'm sure you're going to. I said, oh, I'm sure I will too. And I thought, you know, if people could be kind to people without having to have a bald-headed chemotherapy patient in front of them, if we could all just kind of, you know, pay it forward a little bit, life would be a lot easier sometimes. I think if everybody can live that, that would be good. And I did learn that. I saw a lot of compassion, compassion for the kids if they were with me, especially the youngest one. If Josh was with me, I could feel compassion from people because they'd say, oh, that poor child, look at his mom, sick. It must be horrible for him. And here I'm thinking, well, I feel pretty good despite the fact that I'm obviously not perfectly well. But I could actually feel the compassion coming towards us. And I sometimes wonder if we shouldn't all shave our heads and maybe the world would be a better place. I don't know.
Well, I'm a firm believer that one of the Star Trek series probably has set that as a standard. Isn't there a bald-headed actress in one of them?
Yeah, there is.
I think so. Yeah, I don't
know. Zulu? No. I can't remember the name of the lady.
Paul, when you're not penning rather dark fantasy, you're a member of corporate America. Your role in the family must have changed a great deal during this period.
Yeah, that's something I don't know if that's true or not. I'm trying to wrestle with that one. I've been in a supporting role in our family dynamic more than most men probably are in our culture, just normally. Lori, as a physician, as a resident, when I met Lori, she would often be the person who would just have a ridiculous call schedule, for instance. And I have sort of watched this woman who is really very, very strong get into trouble over, you know, several times in our marriage when she has spread herself too thin. And, you know, I've kind of had to do, you know, an within family intervention and sit her down and say, you know, basically, you're not taking care of yourself, ergo you cannot possibly take care of anybody else, you know, who's close to you, so something needs to change. And those things have come up several times over the course of our marriage. With the cancer episode, as I like to call it, I wanted to be more nurturing and take care of Lori more than she would actually let me. And she would often, the only days of work she missed the whole time she was doing chemotherapy were the days she was actually in the chemotherapy suite. She would sometimes go to work looking literally like death, and I was tremendously worried about her. And I wanted her to stay home for a day or so that I could look after her, let her put her feet up, and all the rest of it. And she had a very interesting take on that. And the other thing was, you know, Lori plays ice hockey and in a women's league here in Nashville. And obviously she couldn't play ice hockey while she was on chemotherapy, especially because if she received any bruising or anything like that, that would be really not very good. But she wanted to go and play in the over 50 women's championship in April of 2009.
I think you have just crossed the line. Lori is going to slap you silly. I mean,
why?
Women that are only 35 years old.
I was just going to say, Simon, that they do take younger women than that age, but you didn't let me get there. I knew where you were going with that. Anyhow, still not giving any specifics of my wife's true age. She wanted to play in this tournament, and she set this as a goal for herself, and she was going to spin class at the Y after working all day during chemotherapy. And I was like, are you out of your mind? And, you know, she didn't look well, and people were very worried about her and all the rest of it. So although what I'm trying to get at in terms of what you're saying about the role changing, my ability to actually affect the role I wanted to have was kind of blocked by her stubborn determination to not allow the cancer to A, block her from her objective of playing in this tournament, but also she felt very strongly that if she couldn't do what she would normally do, it would mean that the cancer was winning. And if there was any conflict that we had, it was around that. It was around the fact that I felt she was driving herself very hard. I also felt I wasn't being, you know, allowed to sort of step into that nurturing role that I wanted to have for her. But I also had to respect why she was taking the path that she was taking. And that was actually really the most difficult thing of all, was to watch her really drive herself as hard as she did.
Lori, obviously you have to respond to this.
I think a couple of things. He's absolutely right when he said, I was afraid that if I gave in and said, you know, I just really feel bad. Like, I really did feel bad a lot of the time, and if I felt like if I gave in, it would be like it was going to get the upper hand, it being the cancer. The other thing was I was trying to really maintain this kind of facade for the boys that, oh, this is just a nuisance. I mean, it's fine. I mean, yeah, I mean, no, I don't look great, but I'm still doing everything I usually do, so it can't be that bad. And I do think, in retrospect, that when I talk to Josh now that he's older, he did kind of buy that. It wasn't that bad. He had a little meltdown quite a bit longer after, you know, I was kind of back on my feet and feeling much better. Unfortunate kind of interaction with one of his teachers who said, all doctors are evil and cancer is just something that doctors make up, and he kind of got a double whammy there. He said, Paul had to talk to him and say, boy, you got him on two counts. His mom's a doctor, and his mom just finished cancer treatment, and the guy felt very badly. But that's when, Josh, I realized he had been, like, kind of using humor to help him cope with it, because he really did have a meltdown. He started kind of crying on the bus, and, you know, he was in eighth grade, and eighth graders don't cry on the bus. And I realized it was tough on them, tougher than I realized, tougher than they even realized. But I tried to just keep going so that I could, you know, convince everyone, including myself, that I was fine. And it worked. And, in fact, this last month, September, I went back for a regular follow-up appointment, and I said to my oncologist, she said, you look great. Are you feeling good? And I said, I feel great. And she said, boy, you're doing everything you always did. This is great. And I said, I feel so much better now than I did even a year ago. You don't realize how bad you feel, so you feel better. And so it was, you know, would I want to go through it again? Not voluntarily. Would I? Probably. But it wasn't a lot of fun most of the time.
That just depends on that. I mean, you know, if this sounds like a lot of denial was going on, that would be exactly what was happening. And I'm a big fan of the TV show Frasier, and I was watching a rerun of Frasier not very long ago, actually, and Martin, who plays Frasier's dad, was talking about something, and be like, you know, in my day we just did this, this, and this, and Frasier, the psychologist's son, says to him, but Dad, that's just denial. And Martin looks right at him and goes, of course it's denial. That's how you cope. You know, so that was kind of, I got it. It was like, yes, it was denial, and that was what was making me frustrated. Lori was not really acknowledging how bad she felt, how sick she was and everything, but that is exactly how she coped with it.
My first
I did get to play hockey.
You did get to play hockey?
I did get to play hockey,
yes.
She
did go to the 2009 tournament for women of a certain age, yes, and they had a great
time.
Let
me guess, you got a special age waiver.
I did, yes. Nicely put.
my first wife was a day home provider for a while, and she ended up in hospital. So I took the day off. I said, oh, I'll look after the little, children, brats, whatever. And so I made them this splendid lunch, steak, which they didn't eat. My wife almost killed me. They don't want steak. They want grilled cheese sandwiches. So, that kind of sums up my ability in the, dealing with children arena. clearly, Paul has a much better ability. It's
it depends
on
the day. Thank you, but it does depend on the day.
It's a very unfair question, but I'm going to ask you both, and you can answer in turn. What was the darkest moment?
I'll let you go first.
I think probably the darkest moment for me was, it was more than one moment, it was the time between the diagnosis being kind of nailed down and not knowing what the lymph node biopsy was going to be. Because that really, for me as a clinician, is like the key to life, as it were. I wanted to know, I wanted to see the histology and the pathology. I wanted to see those lymph nodes just because, your mind in the 2 weeks while you're waiting to get all those answers, it's very difficult. That's the time I think I remember lying in bed just kind of saying, just let me get the kids out of high school, please. Just let me live long enough to get them out of high school. Let me make sure that I've got things tidied up. There was a lot of dark thoughts in that time, and then, as things progressed and it became, looking like it was going to be a much more manageable type of cancer that carried with it a better prognosis than some, you have to look for receptor status. Is it positive? You want your estrogen receptor status to be positive, you do better. And I remember thinking when she called me, the surgeon would tell me, these are the results of this, this, and this, and I go, estrogen receptors? She goes, positive. I go, yes. It was like that, as I kind of checked off the list and realized eventually that I'm going to fall into a group that the prognosis is much better. But until I knew all those answers, it was dark. It was dark for me because, my kids weren't out of the nest yet. I think, I look at myself as kind of the mother bird, and they're not ready. They're not ready to be without me here. And, of course, Paul, he's an adult, and I knew he could, if anything happened, that the worst scenario happened, he would manage, but the kids, it was hard. So that was my darkest moment, was many moments in the weeks that led up to getting all the answers.
Paul.
Yeah, I had two dark moments, or periods in this. One was in late September of 08. Lori had received her diagnosis. Yes, it's breast cancer, but she had not yet had her surgery, which was coming up in early October. And at the same time, my mom was diagnosed with cancer of unknown origin. And she hadn't been terribly well for a while, and she was diagnosed probably 2.5 weeks before she actually ended up dying. So and she lived near my sister up in the interior of British Columbia in a town called Penticton. So in late September of 08, I flew up to Penticton and was with my mom as she passed away, and was dealing with that obviously at an emotional level, and at the same time very concerned about Lori, who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. So for me to be, you know, when I looked at it at the time, wow, both the two most important women in my life have cancer at the same time. And I was with my mom as she died, and I was praying with her and praying over her, and I was really wondering, you know, is this going to be a scenario that, you know, I was praying also that it wouldn't be a scenario that would be repeated with Lori. I came back home a few days after my mom died so that I could be here back in Tennessee for Lori's surgery. And the day after I got home, the dog had pancreatitis, so we didn't know what was wrong with her, but she was just incontinent all over the house. And I was just sitting there, like, cleaning up literally the crap, and Mama just died, Lori was going to go in for surgery, and the dog, God knew what was wrong with her. And I was, you know, I was supposed to take the dog to the vet, and I just was kind of paralyzed, and Lori phoned, I think it was early in the afternoon, and said, "Have you taken the dog to the vet yet?" And I said, "No." And she said, why the bloody hell haven't you taken the dog to the vet? And I said, "I don't really know right now if I could take any more bad news. I don't really want to know if there's anything really tragically wrong with the dog at this point in my life, because I just don't know if I could emotionally handle it." And so that was a very dark day. And as it turned out, the dog was fine, and she's still with us. And, of course, Lori's been through everything that she's been through, and she's still with us. But at that point in time when you don't know, as Lori said, the uncertainty is probably what makes everything darkest. If you know what's going to happen, whether it's good or bad, you can somehow mentally prepare for what's coming next. When you don't know, it's very, very difficult. The other dark time that I had was, as I said, when Lori was losing her hair. And it doesn't sort of magically fall out all at once. You don't, you know, it's kind of an ugly duckling process, to tell you the truth. It kind of begins to fall out in clumps, and some of it's there and some of it's not, and there's bald patches. And that was actually, although it was something that was very difficult emotionally for me to take because of how much, you know, that was, for me, such a physical symbol of who Lori was, I was able to take some action around that. And I ended up being the person that, with her guidance and help, I shaved her head. And so, you know, with my razor. And so that was a tremendously healing and bonding process for us to go through together. And that was helpful that I was able to take some action. But that was also, before I did that, I was very sad. It wasn't dark so much, it's just really, really sad to watch that happen to her.
On the rear cover of your book, The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree, is the Cancer Awareness Pink Ribbon. And as I understand it, you're donating some of your profits to cancer research. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, you know, obviously this whole story that happened in real life mirrored in very strange ways some of the things that I had already written about in my fiction. So that was just odd to experience it in real life, this story that I had written about already. I went through several tries of getting an agent. And, you know, unsuccessfully, the last agent I approached said, you know, this book is really good and it really deserves to be published. Unfortunately, I've already taken on two new authors whose work I can't sell. And so I thought to myself, well, this is interesting, because even if I get an agent, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to get published. So I thought, well, you know, I'll take responsibility for this work. It's good enough. I had professional opinion telling me it was good enough. I felt it was good enough to actually be out there in the world. And so I decided I would take responsibility for making that happen and self-publish it. I also mentally, much like Jake, my hero, I mentally bargained, not bargained, but committed to the universe that I would sell this book myself, and that whoever bought it, I would donate half of my royalties to breast cancer awareness. So that's sort of what I do as a kind of baseline. And in respect of it being October, and that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, this particular month, all online sales, all my royalties will go. I will donate, 100% of my royalties to that initiative.
Okay, and this obviously leads into a shameless commercial break. where can people buy copies of the Fruit of the Den Dragon Tree?
Right now, it's only available online through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. I am also trying to get my own website, which is up and running, which is www.pauldeepin.com. You can't currently buy my book through my own website, but a number of people have asked me for signed copies, and so I'm going to sell signed copies through my website, but they will be a bit more expensive than what they retail for through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I'm also working on getting independent booksellers in the Nashville area try to sell my book as well. But typically, my main marketing effort is going to be online.
How come I didn't get a signed copy?
You did, you liar. I sent one to you. Don't even go there. I sent one to you ages ago. How else did you think you read it?
I'm just messing with you.
You saw it. That's what my mom would say. You saw it.
Laurie, you survived the problem. Do you have to go through regular screenings?
Yeah. I see my surgeon I was seeing her every 3 months, but I graduated to every six. And I see my oncologist every 6 months. And every 6 months I've been doing my favorite new view mammogram called the scar view. I said, I understand a scar view. A diagnostic mammogram makes your breast into a pancake, and a scar view makes it into a crepe. Yes. I said, I understand that. Not very pleasant, but necessary. And I do MRI once a year, breast MRI once a year, which comes up in October. It'll be this month, and then I'll just carry on every 6 months at this point until they're sick of me. And, of course, I take a maintenance drug to block the estrogen receptors that the tumor had, and I take that for 5 years. And I've got 2 years, not quite 2 years of that into me. And then at the end of 5 years, I'll continue to be followed, but not as vigilantly, and I'll certainly do my mammograms on a regular basis and not take no for an answer if I don't feel that they're 100% normal.
The subject of mammograms seems to be a bit of a moving target.
It is right now, yes.
Yeah. I've heard that women should start them in their 50s or 40s or 30s. What's your opinion?
I think women need to have an annual physical every year, and there's been some controversy about self-breast exams, but women know their breasts, and if something's different, I tell my patients, you don't need to be a physician to do a breast exam. You just need to know what you're usually like, and if something's different, you need to come in. There's been a lot of controversy over should you start screening mammograms at age 40 versus age 50, and because there's a lot of false negatives in the younger premenopausal age group. They have denser breasts, and mammograms aren't perfect, and people get a lot of unnecessary biopsy and worry and things done. So I think the medical world has come to the agreement that it's going to be an individual choice between the physician and the woman as to, based on history, based on family history and based on their particular situation, do they have really large breasts, do they have really dense breasts, should you start at age 40 and do it annually or every other year? Definitely at age 50, the literature is absolutely clear that there's benefit at age 50 to have annual mammograms. So I think most of the medical community has decided we're going to do it individual cases at age 40, discuss it with the patient, take a good history, do a good exam, and then decide. Get a good baseline and then baseline mammogram and then decide from there. But it's been controversial.
Mammograms are controversial, but what seems to be abundantly clear is the need for early detection. That seems to be the key.
Yeah, that is key.
What advice would you give
to a patient that wants to know what they should do?
Yes. Any young lady listening?
I think even though people say, the medical community will say self-breast exam is not, it's not reliable, it's not good, it's not whatever. If I had a nickel for every patient I saw who came in because they found an abnormality in their breast that turned out to be a lot more than just something benign, I'd be retired. So I tell women, know your breasts, do your self-breast exam, and if you have a family history, particularly mothers, sisters, aunts on your mother's side with breast cancer, you probably need to get a good screening mammogram, good baseline, because medicine is one of those things that when you get a study done, you always want to know what did it used to look like. So let's get a nice, good, clean mammogram early on. When you're 40, I'd like to get a nice initial mammogram that you can follow with you for the rest of your life. They've lost some of my films through multiple hospitals, the last time I went, I heard, well, we can't find your normal right breast mammogram. And so it's like, oh, darn, because it's probably misfiled somewhere. But now we don't know what that breast looked like 4 years ago or 5 years ago. So try to get a copy of your own films and keep them with you, I think is good advice. And follow and go with, I think your clinician should go with the risk. And I think all women should never take, if the physician's saying, I don't think you need to worry about this and you're worried about it, I don't really care if the physician's not worried about it. It's your body and you've got to push. Some people people have to push sometimes to get what they need done. And I think that's what women have to take, responsibility and control for themselves.
Yeah.
And as an add-on to that, Simon, I can say that I was in the waiting room and the healthcare, I think they were either technicians or nurses or something, they were working on Lori, and they didn't know who I was. And they walked out, and I overheard their conversation. And they were basically saying that she was overreacting by insisting that, she have a biopsy and by insisting that she had surgery. And I knew that they were talking about my wife. And at the time, the prevailing opinion was that her lump was going to be benign. And as it turned out, obviously it wasn't. And I would pay money to have those people back in my sights again, because there is a lot of, there is a lot of drama, certainly from the patient's side. And so I think what sometimes happens to healthcare workers is they get a bit jaded and cynical. But on the other hand, I would definitely agree, as someone who hurts these people talk about my wife in that way, absolutely, if your intuition is telling you there's something more going on here, listen to that inner voice, because Lori did, and I'm pretty sure that that's what helped save her life.
I was talking to my good friends from Southern California yesterday, and this very subject came up. Ashley Brooks is a registered nurse. Manny Barling, a retired attorney. And Ashley came out with the classic line, no one gives a S-H blank blank about your health other than you.
Right.
Thanks. That's right.
Absolutely. I watched an interesting CNN segment earlier this week, and it was about breast cancer and the fact that, you know, October is cancer awareness month, and, you know, how the search for the cure is on. My question is, okay, why look for a cure? Why not look for a prevention?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think, you know, for the most part, though, people are pretty lazy about prevention can be hard work. It's like the diabetics. I mean, they don't like to watch what they eat, and they don't like to exercise. They would really like a cure so they didn't have to work so hard. But I think everyone has to do their part, the patient, the physicians, everyone in the healthcare system. So trying to do the right thing is very important. Trying to reduce your risk factor is very important. We now know that probably postmenopausal hormones after 10 years increase your risk of breast cancer. So, you know, I hate it when I see a 70-year-old who's been on high-dose estrogens for 40 years. That's a bit of an overkill. And, you know, you have to sit down and talk to them about it. They don't like to give it up, and God knows I didn't like to give mine up. But, you know, that's the thing you've got to do is try not to get into the higher risk groups by doing things that you shouldn't do.
Are you talking about the lifestyle prevention or a therapeutic prevention?
Actually, both.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, as having watched Laura do this, she really did do everything she possibly could do from a lifestyle preventive perspective. She ate well. She exercised. You know, she didn't drink. She wasn't overweight. She didn't smoke, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, there's really not much you can do better than she did from a lifestyle point of view, and yet she still ended up with the diagnosis. How rare is that? I couldn't say. I mean, I'm not conversant enough with the numbers of women who end up with a diagnosis of breast cancer in the absence of any sort of lifestyle change that they could have affected. Therapeutically, it's an interesting question. I'm not really familiar with what might be going on that way, but then you'd have to sort of determine whom you gave a preventative agent to and what sort of screening tests would you be running in order to decide that. And I don't know. Politically, one thing I did become very aware of, especially after my wife was diagnosed, breast cancer is a very politically sensitive disease state, and there'd be all sorts of ethical and sort of social and political questions that would need to be answered, even from a preventative standpoint as well.
That answered the question with 8 gazillion more questions.
Tell me all.
All right. I've got a really fun question. You know, we've been talking about these heavy, important, serious subjects. Laurie, what do you think about The Fruit of the Dendragon Tree? Did you like the book?
Yes, I do like the book, and I'm like you. I'm not much of a fantasy reader. When Paul first told me he was writing fantasy, my mind went to some different fantasy, and I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, you know, like dragons and centaurs and, you know, all sorts of cool stuff. And I thought, oh, okay, I get it. Well, that's a relief, because I wasn't sure how exactly where he was going with it. But when I first, you know, I read parts of it and helped edit parts of it and things like that. So when you're editing, you're not really reading. You're kind of looking for, you know, is this what he meant to say? And then, you know, it's not as pleasant. But after, you know, the book was published and I started reading it again, and I come out of the bedroom and I say, you know, you're a pretty good writer. He'd say, well, gee, thanks. And, you know, we've given several copies of the book to people at work that I work with, and I've had, I just had one of the nurses in one of the clinics that I do on a Thursday, it's a little bit west of Nashville, she said, I was checking my email, and I looked up, and she had the book in her hand, and she said, you tell him to get going on the sequel right now. So did one of the other nurses. She said, I know. What's he doing? He just called her. He's like taking a drumming lesson or something. Like, he should be writing. He has no business doing anything else. He needs to get the end of the, he needs to get the next one out pretty quick. So I know that it's gone over really big. People said, I didn't expect to like this book at all. I really just picked it up because, you know, that Paul wrote it and we know him, but man, it's really good. And it is really well written, and it's a very good book, and it's easy to read. And very entertaining. I remember when he kind of went through the whole premise with me, and I just found out that I'd had, you know, was diagnosed with breast cancer, and he was like explaining, you know, boy, this is just a little bit too much like my book, because I kind of stayed away from asking him a lot about it until he got it almost completely ready to be edited. And I said, so how does Mary do? You know, the lady, the mom with breast cancer, and he had this kind of pained look on his face. I said, okay, well, let's hope, you know, life doesn't...
Don't stop talking. Just don't ruin me, Andy.
I won't. But I was like, okay, well, I hope I don't end up in hospice, but okay.
Actually, I have to ask you, Paul.
Now I'll have to sleep,
That must have been a pretty awkward moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's my book is dark. There's no, I shouldn't say it quite like that. There are certainly darker themes in my book, and that was also part of the concern I had after real life seemed to be imitating art in so many different ways. You know, one of my heaven-sent prayers was, well, let's hope that, you know, it's not quite as bad as what happens in Den Dragon Tree. But, you know, without trying to give away too much, there's all sorts of other things, obviously, that are going on in the fictional story that clearly couldn't happen in real life, like witches and vampires and dragons and things. And, you know, it was a relief to me that Laurie liked the work, because I know that she doesn't normally read fantasy. And one of my internal explicit objectives was to make this book something that people who wouldn't normally gravitate to that genre want to read and recommend to their friends. And I think, you know, based at least so far on the people who have read it, who do fall into that category, there's certainly enough there to keep anyone who is interested in the genre and reads in that genre. It fulfills all the sort of, you know, it checks off the list. I mean, it's just a straightforward fantasy book, but for people who don't normally read it, it's also got a lot of interest for them, and I'm really happy that is kind of the theme that I'm hearing in terms of feedback.
Yes, I have to admit that, you know, fantasy's not my favorite, but I rather liked it because it was so dark-themed, but you know, by dark themed, I don't mean brutally dark. It was,
right.
Yeah. I mean, it was more inferred dark.
Right. And there were choices that the characters have to make between dark and light, and you know that's kind of what also plays out in real life. I mean, you're confronted with a dark situation. What are you going to do? How are you going to behave? What choices are you going to make? And certainly from that perspective, writing the book in a funny kind of way was almost preparation for what happened with Lori and the boys, you know, when she was diagnosed with breast cancer afterwards, because it very clearly put into relief, well, okay, what are you going to do now that you actually have to, you know, go through some of these things that your fictional characters that you wrote about, what are you going to be? Who are you going to be in this story now?
Paul, have your two boys read the book?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, and I'm after them all the time, they have not finished it. And to get back to what the story was saying, it was like, you know, wow, you're actually a pretty good writer. This seems to be the almost surprise discovery amongst my family. Josh came to me and said, this is a really well-written book, Dad. And I'm like, why are you sounding so surprised? Because, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, he's enjoying it. He hasn't finished it yet. And I actually, both my boys had difficulty reading it earlier because of the resonance of the breast cancer story and how close to home that cut for them. Josh is now able to read it a bit more freely because, you know, he's past the point where it's you know, so hard for him to deal with that theme. But also, as you know, Simon, having read the book, that's not the all-pervading context of the story either. I mean, a lot of the story is about Jake, the protagonist, and how his relationship with his father evolves, about how they're going to deal with life without the mother and their wife, or, you know, what's it going to be like for them, and, you know, how their relationship evolves is really key to the story. And so from that perspective, you know, and then there's all the action and the battles and all that kind of stuff. So it's I think he's able to read it a bit more now from that perspective.
Oh, I think the book operates on levels other than pure fantasy. I see a great deal of real life in it. And you don't often find that in a fantasy work.
Right.
No,
and that's exactly the explicit direction I wanted to go in. I mean, it is a new world, it is a creation of a new world and all that, but it's like, what would it really be like if you had to really deal with some of this stuff, which is not what a lot of fantasy gets to.
Laurie, are you giving him permission to write a second book?
Definitely. I keep saying to him, so did you write today? He goes, at work I did.
Yeah.
But did you write? I'm getting pressure in one of these clinics for the sequel. You gotta come up with it. Yeah, so I do think it would be a great book for us. I mean, a sequel would be great for this book. And he's got it plotted out. He just has to sit down and do it. Its problem is, of course, he's trying to market it, and he's trying to work, and he's trying to write, and he's trying to do, you know, the stuff that one does around the home, too. And it's just, it becomes a time thing. But it's doable.
Without giving away any big secrets, do you want to share a little bit about the sequel?
Sure. There is Witch in this world who helps Jake go to the other world. She ends up in that world too in the sequel. And it becomes quite clear, even in the first book, that there's somewhat of an attraction between her and Jake. And how that plays out in the second book, given that Jake has actually kind of almost, quote-unquote, had to get married, what that looks like. And there is a dragon in the first book who ends up being, you know, released and pretty much left to his own devices, and he's like this big pink elephant in the middle of this world now. Like, what are we going to do with him? And so the sequel is really about what kind of action and what kind of sacrifice is necessary in order to deal with this dragon, and you know, what choices people have to make in order for that to happen. The first book's theme was more along the lines of cancers, though whether they're real or metaphorical, sometimes require poisons to defeat them. The metaphorical poison in the first book was the dragon. He did defeat the cancer, sort of notionally, that they wanted to defeat. So the second book now is, well, now we've got this poison, how do you dissolve the poison that you've released? And so that's more or less what all the characters will have to deal with.
Okay, I have to ask another very unfair question. The names Jake and Josh are not a thousand miles apart. Has your son figured out that maybe, just maybe, part of the character is based on him?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because actually Jake is my older son's middle name. It's Jacob. And so when I very first started writing the book, I just picked Jake because that was my son's middle name, and it was a way of really feeling a connection. You know, it was kind of an artifice, really, of feeling that paternal connection with this boy. If I could make, you know, that connection through kind of giving him a name that was very close to my older son's middle name, that would be, that was just sort of how I did that. And so I could always very much feel Jake. I could feel that connection as a father to that boy in my writing, and I think that comes through fairly honestly. I won't say effectively, but I will say honestly. I mean, it's an authentic emotion that the father has for his son. Now, talk about sibling rivalry. Ben figured out, obviously, that Jake was his name, and so he says to Josh, well, you know, Dad used my name.
He didn't pick you.
Josh is meanwhile crushed. So coming back to the sequel, I've actually had to make it just in terms of family harmony that Jake's name is actually Joshua Jacob Patel, so that they can both be satisfied that didn't favor one of them over the other.
I have to admit that I love that story. I didn't know what kind of answer I was going to get to the question, but that's a great one.
It's amazing, isn't it? I'm actually now having to name my character certain things in order to keep peace in the home. It's ridiculous, but there it is.
When are you hoping to get this to print?
Wow, that's a question I'm almost scared to answer, because it always takes longer than you want it to, and it usually takes longer than you think. But I really would like to have an editable first draft, at least, in about a year's time. I don't think it's really feasible to think about doing it much sooner than that. I almost certainly will use Pat's services again. He just did such a great job on the first book, and he's familiar with the story, you know, and I'm just really anxious to get it going. It's been simmering. And what I noticed is that, and I think a lot of writers talk about this process, there's a lot of writing that goes on in your head when you're not actually sitting either at the keyboard or with a pen and a pad of paper to hand. It's almost like, in a funny kind of way, the book is sort of writing itself. I mean, you do have to sit down and do the slog of putting words on paper or on a screen, but there's a lot of it that happens in the back of your mind and in your subconscious. And I'm very happy with some of the themes that are coming up in this sequel. So I'm fairly confident that I can do this. I can get an editable version out within about a year, and then, you know, however many months it takes to redo and then get it into print. But I did notice that I got to be a better writer, you know, as the process wore on. So I'm hoping that part of it, since I'm very clear about how I want the sequel to end already, and I'm very clear about how it's beginning already, I think it should be a much faster process than the first book was.
Yeah, I'm interested in your comment about You're writing in your head, not with your fingers. I work very much the same way. I went out for a quick walk last night. I was thinking about a DVD review that I was putting together. And I came back and, you know, it was just a blur on the keyboard. I knew where I wanted to go, but it took me some time to, you know, bring it together.
Absolutely.
Our time is winding down here. Laurie, I want to come back to you and ask you for your parting thoughts. What should people do to protect themselves against the evil Big C?
I think people need to, it has to be an all-encompassing thing, just like your physical being has to be optimized the best you can. Your spiritual being, you have to be in, you have to have harmony in your life. You have to do balance, and as Paul mentioned earlier, sometimes I'm not very good at balance. And this has made me reevaluate that. I think if a person can, you just have to do the best you can do and be the best person you can be and try to not poison ourselves with things we shouldn't poison ourselves with, overeating, under-exercising, and just, I tell patients, you know, you probably take care of your car better. I bet you every 3 months you get your oil changed, but I haven't seen you for a year and a half in here. So try to do the things that you should do to ensure that you're going to be on the straight and narrow with your health. And listen to people and try to be the best person you can be at many, many levels. And I think that will be the thing that gets you through it and gets you into a kind of a preventive mode so that you don't end up too far advanced when you kind of pop into care or decide something's not right. Just be mindful all the way along. Just be a good person. I think that helps.
It would be easy to slip this conversation into the whole healthcare debate, but
right.
I won't go there. But that is way too dangerous.
Yes.
Paul, I'd like to get your parting thoughts.
Wow. You know, we've covered a lot of ground, Simon, and it's interesting. We always end up talking about things that we don't plan on, even though we have sort of a fairly good structure for where we go. Laurie touched on something that is certainly part of my book, and it's certainly something that I think people would be well advised to be mindful on at all times, not just as a reason for preventing cancer. But the spiritual dimension of one's life is something that can't be ignored. We almost have a spiritual obligation to take care of our health. In many religious traditions, whether it's Buddhist or Hindu or Christian, the body is the temple through in which the soul resides. And so we almost have a spiritual obligation to be mindful of how we treat our bodies. We have a duty here on this earth to become who we truly are and to take care of our real self and become our real self. And the book touches on those things, and certainly Laurie's real life adventures, if you will, or misadventures, and the ride that we all went on together with her breast cancer journey definitely makes that even a more profound realization for me than I think it would have been otherwise. And I'm definitely mindful at a spiritual level in ways that I was not before, you know, she received her diagnosis.
I want to truly, truly thank both of you for taking time to talk with us today. And I'm going to extend an invite. Would you be prepared to come back to talk again on this subject?
Oh, absolutely, I will.
Yes, I'm in. Thank you very much for both the nice comments and the invitation.
Okay, I do need to wrap this program up. My guests today have been Paul Deepan and his wife, Lori Deepan. I want to truly thank the pair of you for taking time out to spend with us, and hopefully we will be talking again soon. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett, wishing everyone a wonderful Sunday. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you, Simon.